This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, July 30th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. In 1802, President Thomas Jefferson signed into law the Military Peace Establishment Act, which created a regiment of military engineers within the U.S. Army. Over the following 200 years, the Army Corps of Engineers, as it came to be known, has overseen large-scale engineering projects during wartime and peacetime, at home and abroad, including the construction of the Washington Monument and the Panama Canal. In an era when the Trump administration has adopted an adversarial relationship with many federal agencies, the Army Corps of Engineers remains remarkably well-resourced and effective. In March, the Corps reconstituted New York's Jacob Javits Convention Center into a 2,500-bed field hospital to combat the coronavirus pandemic, a project that took only 4 days. It has since constructed dozens of facilities around the country to care for COVID-19 patients. But Trump's affection for the Corps mostly arises from the fact that it has been tasked with constructing the wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. Todd Semonite, the commanding general of the Corps, was appointed by President Obama, but like many other military officers serving in the government, he considers his work nonpartisan. Semonite accompanied Trump last September during his visit to a section of the border wall in San Diego, where they had this exchange.
And one thing we haven't mentioned is technology. They're wired so that we will know if somebody's trying to break through, and you may want to discuss that a little bit, General.
Sir, there could be some merit in not discussing that.
Okay. I like that.
Paige Williams, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss the history of the Corps, how it has responded to the shortage of hospital beds during the pandemic, and the struggles of a government agency to remain apolitical. Paige, it's so nice to have you back on the program.
It's so nice to be here.
And I will say that it is a relief to be talking about a government agency that has not been gutted over the last several years and that retains the admiration of the American public. So although the Corps was officially established in 1802, it actually traces its roots back, as I learned from you, even further than that. Why and when was the Corps of Engineers established?
Well, George Washington established the first position of Chief of Engineers in what became the United States at the outset of the Revolutionary War. There were battlements that needed to be built. There were fortifications that needed to be engineered and overseen. He drew, and his troops drew, a lot of their expertise from the French. We had to borrow our engineering expertise from overseas at that time until we could build up our own engineering corps. And that was done largely through West Point, which is where Todd Semonite, as you mentioned, attended.
We usually associate the Corps with disaster relief during hurricanes and tornadoes when we see those troops out there stacking sandbags and clearing debris. But they've had their share of failures in recent years. We saw it when the levees broke in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina and the restoration of Puerto Rico's power grid after Hurricane Maria. That took 11 months, I believe.
Yeah, it seems like you only ever hear about the Corps when something goes wrong and when there's controversy attached. And that's almost always the case with large federal agencies. And this one, it's now a $60 billion federal agency that's grown enormously under Semonite in the past 4 years. So there's a lot of room for things to go wrong, and things often do. And that's when you hear a lot of complaint. And to be fair, those are the moments when you can go in and do audits and figure out where the weaknesses are. But in this case, in the case of the coronavirus treatment centers, they mobilized quickly and they got started ahead of what Semonite and his staff called getting ahead of the need. So they really wanted to be out in the field before the phone rang so that they could meet the communities where they were in terms of their specific COVID-19 curves.
you spent some time with Semonite, and he really seems to embody the central values of the Corps: ingenuity, speed, you know, a spirit of can-do energy, sometimes almost to a comical extent. Maybe give us just a little bit about his background.
Yes, he became an instant, well, Trump named him and called him a big star, of course. But in this case, Semonite is extremely well known among his staff for being capable and being almost obsessive in his wish to deliver when he says he's going to deliver. And so that was part of the push behind his mandate to get beds on the ground within 30 days in some cases in these coronavirus hotspots, starting with New York.
Yeah, and maybe tell us a little bit about that. What happened after Governor Andrew Cuomo asked Trump to send the Corps to New York?
Cuomo, when he was at HUD, when he worked for the federal government, he spent some time working with the Army Corps of Engineers and knew well their capabilities. He specifically asked for the Army Corps because he knew that they can build out anything quickly. So after Cuomo asked for help, the White House sent the Corps in. The Department of Defense asked Semonite to go to Albany and to help New York fix its problem. And it was on his way back from Albany in the DOD jet that Semonite realized that the problem would be nationwide and that other states would need help and that the Corps needed to lay out some sort of modular plan that any community anywhere could implement quickly in order to save lives.
And it's interesting that he was reaching that realization while the administration was in the early phases of claiming that the virus was going to magically disappear. And he just went ahead and did what he saw was inevitable.
Yeah, you know, there's a little known unit in Huntsville, Alabama that was created in the 50s related to missile defense and missile programs. And it's called Huntsville Center. Semonite asked them to figure out what could be done. How do we expand bed space, hospital bed space, beyond the capabilities that the hospitals are already planning for? So they started thinking about how to convert existing structures that were already built to code into, people call these field hospitals, but they're really not. They're actually alternate care facilities. So they started thinking about how to transform hotels and dorms and gymnasiums and community centers. And they came up with some fairly innovative ideas that went into play within weeks.
So tell us about the PODS containers. I was fascinated by those.
PODS. So PODS, okay, let me get this right. Portable on-demand storage, I think, is what the PODS stands for. If you've ever been around the military at all, you know that there are these things called CONEX trailers, CONEX units. They're these big steel shipping containers, basically. They have a small footprint. They're easy to convert. They're easy to use. And that's basically what a PODS container is. But it's got these slightly more flexible side paneling units of a sort of a hard plastic. It's PVC plastic, I think. And it's got one end of it has a roll-up door, like a U-Haul. So they got the idea, the engineers got the idea to take one of those PODS / CONEX containers and turn it into an ICU unit. And so the research and development unit of the Army Corps of Engineers is in Vicksburg, Mississippi, my home state, and I never knew this, but this R&D unit is in Vicksburg because of the historic flood of 1927. And they've been doing research and development there ever since. And those guys, those tradesmen, they can build anything. They can build absolutely anything. And so Semonite called him and said, turn one of these pods into an ICU. It needs to have negative pressure, which sucks, you know, dirty air out through a high-powered filter. It needs to have X, Y, and Z. And so the men turned it into an ICU unit within 24 hours, which told them that this system is deployable, it's scalable, it's economical, it met the standards that they all sort of hoped they would meet.
In April, I believe, you visited SUNY Stony Brook near Stony Brook University Hospital in Long Island, where the Corps was building one of their alternate care centers. What did you find there? What was the scene like?
Stony Brook was the first site that I visited. I visited five of these sites over weeks and weeks in the spring and early summer. And that one, so there's the football stadium, there's baseball and softball fields, there's soccer, there's this lovely soccer field. All of that had basically vanished, except for the soccer field. The Stony Brook officials did not want the tents and the Corps of Engineers activity to happen on the field so that the students would have something to come back to and to play on. So when I got there, it was crawling with machines and I think over 900 construction workers. There were five enormous tents. These are the kinds of tents that you could do a trapeze show in or put airplanes in. These are gigantic tents, and they were laying plywood floors that they then were covering with this resin that would become hardened so that it could be easily cleaned. They had turned the basketball arena into a command center. So there was a VIP box that was where they had their meetings, a skybox. And then on the floor, there were models of the complex care units that they were installing and other patient care units that they were installing in the tents. So it was just this beehive of activity. And so it was this huge and complex collaboration of federal, commercial, and academic officials trying to get one job done, which was to create a place that ambulances could pull up, doctors and nurses and techs and staff could come in and save the lives of people who needed saving.
And then I really like the pride they take in their work. You talk to one Corps person who was there who said, you know, to layman, it's like, fire sprinklers. To an engineer, this is like amazing because it had just taken, a week?
Yeah. That was in one of those big tents. So they had, it's like, if you look up, it's like gridding or like the beams of a ceiling, but it's these sprinkler systems that, and I think Colonel Asbury expected me to just genuflect or something when I saw the sprinklers, but I was just like, interesting. And that's when he leapt in and said, oh, this is amazing. Are you kidding? This is amazing. To a civilian, it's like, okay, sprinklers. But to us, this is a huge deal. So they took a lot of pride in it. The contractors did too. And these were multi-million dollar contracts. These were big, big contracts. And someday there will be an interesting story to be written about, you know, how the money got spent. That's not to say that it was spent badly or wrong in any way. I'm just saying that it was a big, huge capital outlay that manifested in sprinkler systems and resin floors and everything that you would want to see in a hospital room, almost everything you would want to see. There was a day when one of the tents, a big windstorm came through, one of the tents took some wind damage. So there were serious matters to consider that you wouldn't consider in a hospital necessarily, but this was the next best thing, it seemed like.
So the Corps is the one government agency that is working actively on the pandemic and trying to do everything it can to stave off disaster. It's also the one government agency that Trump actually likes. So he's encouraged Semonite to appear more often on Fox News, and he's tried to exploit his popularity on behalf of his pet project, which is the border wall. So maybe tell us a little bit about that.
You know, Semonite represents a lot of what it's thought impresses Trump. He's forceful. He's decisive. He speaks in these fluid, complete, confident, declarative sentences. He is incapable of giving a list on television or otherwise without counting off the talking points on his fingers. He's a very linear thinker. And at press briefings and in other meetings, Trump has almost always singled him out for praise. And my sources told me that after Semonite became a big hit, largely through the Rachel Maddow show, that the Trump administration wanted to see him out there actively participating in Fox News' coverage. And so Semonite wasn't into that. He said, I cannot be the Fox News general. I want to mix it up. I will go on CNN and MSNBC and CBS and NBC. And so he did. He tried to be democratic in the way that he handled himself and to answer Trump's questions about the wall when they came up, even within the context of the coronavirus, which was always odd. He tried to be diplomatic. He is diplomatic. He's trained to be apolitical. He learned that at West Point. He learned that in the Army. Hundreds and hundreds of the people in his staff are Army. They're soldiers. And so they're trained to not behave politically and speak politically in public. And so that is an oath that you can see him enact over and over again when he remains cordial but firm about what he will and won't say.
Semonite's a three-star general, and there have been other decorated generals who have tried and failed to work with Donald Trump. You can just list them off. Jim Mattis, his former Secretary of Defense, John Kelly, his former Chief of Staff, Joseph Dunford, the former Chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and H.R. McMaster, his former National Security Advisor. Semonite is close to retirement. Maybe he was even about to retire when the pandemic hit. What are his plans as it continues to intensify?
He was set to retire on March 17th, I believe, at midnight, maybe the 18th. When I was there, he had three boxes in his office, one marked Semonite : sentimental, which had his mom's obit in it and some other materials that he had collected over the past 4 years in that location. And then two others, one marked COVID and one marked wall. And he had started packing, but on May 12th, he got a notice from the Department of Defense, from Secretary Esper, and from the Trump administration that he was being asked to stay on indefinitely. And when I asked Semonite why he thought he had been extended, and he said, well, there's a couple of projects that we're working on, COVID being one of them. And I said, is the other one the wall? And he said, yeah, probably. So I don't think it's any mystery that Trump sees him as someone who can push that project to the finish, because Semonite is a taskmaster. He's demanding. He's aggressive. He is a proponent of what he calls ruthless execution. He simply believes in getting a job done that he said he would get done. And that is sort of a double-edged sword, I guess, because he got COVID done for whatever purpose it served. But then he's also going to get this wall done, I guarantee it.
Thanks so much, Paige.
Thank you.
Paige Williams is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of The Dinosaur Artist, Obsession, Betrayal, and the Quest for Earth's Ultimate Trophy. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.